Welcome back to another episode of Live It Well. I hope you've been enjoying the guests that we've been having so far this season. It's been a joy for me to be having these conversations, and this week is no different. We're going to welcome my friend Chris. We've known each other for about 15 years. We were connected when I was working on a project, and Chris was a resource for me during that project. And as I was thinking through who has interesting stories, unique perspectives, Chris immediately came to mind, and the conversation didn't disappoint. It's not going to disappoint for you. We talk about a lot of things: love, relationships, marriage, dating, careers. He's had a really interesting career and a really good lesson, I think, for anyone out there who's a little uncertain or wants a little bit more. Has some really good advice about that. We also get into some heavy stuff, and I think that's really where the rubber meets the road. It's how he's kind of taken on this the situation that he's in, and I don't want to spill those beans. I'm going to let him do that during the interview. But Chris is a wonderful guy. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Up next, my conversation with author and friend, Chris Amezan. So Chris, you and I have known each other for, like, online. We've never actually met in person, but for quite a while. We got connected through a mutual friend of ours, and we're talking here. And before, you know, we started recording, we were talking about life, you know, working from home with Corona and all that good stuff. So how's it in Florida right now?
It's a little strange because the cities and counties are putting really heavy restrictions on, but the state has yet to move that direction to mandate the entire state. So it's a bit strange. Lots of photos coming from the west coast of Florida of spring break crowds on the beach. and here in Miami Beach, in South Beach, it's just so oddly quiet,
I saw. So, yeah. I think it was a UK paper posted a bunch of pictures of, like, 3 weeks ago and then this week of, like, downtowns and beaches, and it was eerie.
Yeah, that's exactly the way it is. Although I've realized that I've been preparing this for this because the past few months I've been practicing social isolation anyway. So, it's kind of like, okay, well, that's no different.
So. And you and I both, work in offices. And I never really considered, I love people and I love getting together with people, but never really considered myself like a full-fledged extrovert, but man, I miss people.
Yeah. I'm introverted. So, for me, this is going to get a little bit annoying. I'm fine because I'm having interactions with my colleagues online, and
yeah.
So for me, it's okay.
So that actually, I'm going to jump right in because you work in learning and development, and you've been doing that for a number of years, but you just said you're an introvert. So how do you mesh that together when you're in charge of helping people learn and grow?
It's amazing. And we get that question all the time. My team of five, we're all introverts on my team. But people love us to facilitate because it's not about how we actually are able to interact with people. It's just about where you get your energy from. So, after maybe two or three straight days of facilitation, at one of our posts, we're just exhausted, like just falling into bed, exhausted. Whereas an extrovert feels probably more energy from doing that. So I think that's the big difference. It's just a different drain on energy. It's
all, yeah. And before we got to talking, you had kind of told me a little backstory about how you got into this kind of role. And I found it really interesting because I worked for a guy in New York who's very much like, ask for things that you want, be open and honest. I'll be open and honest with you. And if you want to do something that we're not going to do as a company, I'll find you the place where you can do that. And so what you told me about how you got this gig was really interesting. Why don't you tell people how you got into this?
Well, I was in banking most of my career. There was a little 2-year stint there as a flight attendant, and that's just a crazy detour that life takes us on. But I went back into banking when I left that job, and worked as an assistant branch manager and went to a training course. And it was taught by a woman that I knew from church. And so I just approached her afterwards. I kind of said, you know what you do looks pretty interesting. And she said, really? And I said, yeah. She said, well, do you want to give it a try? And I kind of laughed. I was like, well, yeah, of course. And she's like, no, I'm serious. We have a need. They needed someone to take over training new hire tellers. And they put me on temporarily. And then I just never went back, you know, and have done all sorts of stuff at this point. But that's, being in the right place at the right time and talking to the right person.
And I don't disagree. I mean, that's, you have to kind of just say what you want to say, and you never know what's going to happen. How has, you've been in banking for a long time. How has that world changed? I mean, I assume you were in the space, what, 12, 13 years ago when we had some challenging times.
So Yeah. I mean, you know, I've been out of banking. Well, actually, let's see, when did I go out the last time? Well, not that long. I think the industry has changed. Someone I know was doing Community Reinvestment Act work, and those regulations have gotten, you know, much, much, much wider. And I think, you know, and of course, the last bank that I worked for was a private bank. So that was a completely different animal. So, you know, I think it's just the move online was the big thing for banking, you know, and these huge branches that still exist. You know, they used to have, you know, like 10 tellers or whatever. Now they've got two or three, and that's it. You know, so I think that's really the biggest shift that I see. But I haven't been in the industry for several years now.
So. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm going to kind of change subjects, because the reason we originally got connected was I was working on a book or book idea. And I feel like the timing was you had just had your first one published. So I'm wondering if you can talk to the audience, to me, about the first book that you wrote.
Yeah. The first book, was somewhat, well, loosely semi-autobiographical.
There are some in the writing.
Yeah, I wouldn't go even that far to use it. That's the only words I know. And it, you know, it was really just me wanting to, you know, to write something about gay characters, because they're really just, you know, there really wasn't a lot of new stuff out there from what I saw. It's just a cute, you know, happy ending, beach read kind of romance thing. So, you know, I mean, it was a lot of fun to write, and, you know, going through that process was fun. That's pretty much it.
So you've written a second one called Finding Mississippi. What was that? Talk me through that one, 'cause I didn't know you'd done that.
Yeah. I just went directly to Amazon on that one. And I had been working on it for a while, and just decided after some major change in my life to go ahead and finish it. And that's kind of based on my experience having family and grandparents in Mississippi, in Southern Mississippi. This is the experience of a gay guy and his boyfriend having to go back to their home, to the hometown, because of a death, you know, and how they kind of interact and learn some things about the family that nobody knew, and also how, you know, how this small town reacts to, you know, suddenly it's these two gay guys here, right? the only ones in town, you know, which I imagine would be the case. So it's a little bit deeper than the first one, but I think, you know, it's sort of in the same vein, but also, you know, happy ending, that sort of thing, because I just like to do that for people.
Well, I think you also told me a little bit about your own coming out story, and how, I mean, coming out is never, most times I would say, like, not super easy or happy on day one. But I think more times than not, we're getting to that point where it is a lot of happy, or at least amicable endings to stories, where we can start the new chapter and it's okay. Which I find true. There's a lot of truth in that. Like, just because you wrote a book that's got a happy ending, life is like that, I think, a lot of times. even if we don't.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, yes.
Because you said that your mom already knew, and your dad took a while, but came around. So like,
yeah. Go ahead.
No, why don't you just tell me about that whole process like if you remember the day, like the year that happened, to give some context.
Yeah, so that was, I guess it was maybe 1996, okay. I think. So I was, you know, very young, early 20s. You know, and it's funny because you mentioned that about my mother. Mothers do just know.
They do.
There's just, you know, there's just, and especially with their sons, they just kind of know. But the context of this was that, you know, I had been in a marriage with a woman, because that's what I was supposed to do. But I got divorced. That's when I got a job as a flight attendant, got based in San Francisco, you know, changed my life completely, met new friends, all that kind of stuff. And it's funny because my father worked for Delta Airlines for almost 25 years. And, you know, at that time, still, even at that time, you know, if you were male and a flight attendant, you know, it was pretty much guaranteed that you're gay, which is not certainly not the case anymore. So I thought, yeah, he'll figure this out, but he just didn't. I don't know why. And he was surprised, and his reaction was very, it was not a good reaction at all. And we've come such a long way. He actually said, you know, this is a path that you'll regret. And I'm kind of like, oh boy, okay.
Yeah.
You know, so I didn't want to get into it, you know, and so I guess the relationship with my parents got back on solid footing through my mother, you know, because, you know, she knew she was okay. And, you know, but obviously at that time, you know, she would worry, and she always worries, you know, is somebody going to hurt your feelings? You know, it's that kind of thing. So she's just a mom.
I don't know what role the church played. I mean, I know you had church in your life. I grew up as a Missouri Synod Lutheran, and my parents still go, and my sister, my whole family's kind of from that group. Me coming out was a super big challenge for my entire family. But in the end, what really brought my family around was they had to sit down with my pastor, or my parents' pastor. I didn't grow up with him, and he basically just said, "Look, Richard is a child of God, and that's all you need to know and care about." And that was the trigger for them. Like, that was okay. We can be okay then.
Yeah. You know, the church. I mean, for me, I was raised Southern Baptist. So you know, that's a very I'll just say it's a very strict set of not just rules but cultural norms and guidelines. And to me, the role that played was, you know, I was just afraid, you know, I was just terrified, you know, and I always laugh, and it's not funny, and it's not a joke, but you know, I had to get into college before I learned that Catholicism is not actually a cult but a real religion. so it was kind of like that, and that kept, I think that just kept me going, going in a direction that I didn't want to go, but I was afraid to do anything differently, you know, just because it had been you know, so pounded into your head that you know, gays and Catholics were lining the road to hell. And that's terrifying, you know. It's absolutely terrifying for somebody, even when you turn 18 or 19 or 20 or whatever. It's scary. It's really scary.
It is scary. That's so interesting that you had been taught or told that Catholicism is a cult. That's just very, very different than even what I grew up with. So, but that shapes us, right? I mean, it's a big part of who we are, and then we have to break those barriers down.
Yeah, we do. And that was really, I remember how I felt at that time. And it was just, you know, I can't describe it. You know, it's just like being helpless and just afraid and mad. And, you know, it's just, this whole mix of emotions that just kept coming. Yeah. Yeah.
So I have one more question. You mentioned that you did get married straight out of high school, and that didn't last very long.
It was straight out of college.
Straight out of college.
I was in high school. Yeah. So we were still very young. I'll put it to you that way.
How did she take it at the end?
It's really funny because, and I keep saying that, but it's not funny. Before we got married, we worked for the same bank, right? And so one of the people she worked with was like, you know, Chris is gay, right? And she kind of laughed it off. And I look back and I see him now and I'm like, well, takes one to know one, right? Yeah. You know, she kind of laughed it off. But you know, lo and behold, there's other people telling her when I couldn't even tell myself, right? When we actually got a divorce, we actually separated after about 12 months, I wrote a letter to her and explained it to her. I could not see her in person, and haven't seen her since. I regret that to this day. So I think it was a matter of, from what I understand, it was just, it was still a total shock to her. But I do know that she now has the life that I think she wanted from me, and that's good. So
that is good.
Yeah. Yeah. But that was tough. That was tough. Cause you know, I felt like I was really letting somebody down, and I was, so.
But then you decided in that moment to live your own truth, and, yeah. There's power in that on the other side of the, on the other side of the page.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you been looking for the next best clothing brand? I found it for you. It's Bruck & Co. Their designs are awesome. Their clothes fits great. They feel good. They look good. And best yet, you can go from the gym, go to dinner, play with the kids, go to the barbecue. They're utilitarian and they work everywhere for any occasion. Check them out, bruckandco.com, that's bruckandco.com, to check out their designs, check out their shirts, their other products. I love them, I wear them, I'm proud to support them on this podcast. And for you, our loyal listeners, we have a discount just for you. If you go visit them at bruckandco.com and use the code LIVEITWELL, LIVEITWELL, just like it sounds, live it well, you'll get 10% off your next purchase. Again, so proud to endorse them. Love their gear, love their designs. They're modern, they're fun, they're different. You're not going to see them anywhere else. Check them out, bruckandco.com. Use the code LIVEITWELL for 10% off. And thank you so much for listening to this show. Did you know that the sixth leading cause of death in the United States is Alzheimer's disease? And that 1 in 3 seniors dies with Alzheimer's or other dementia, and it kills more than breast cancer and prostate cancer combined? I know times are tough, but I'm asking for your help. As the chair of the Iowa Board of Directors of the Alzheimer's Association for the next 2 years, I am working harder than ever to raise awareness and to raise funds to rid the world of Alzheimer's and all other dementias. And your money doesn't just go to research. It goes to care and support groups, which are free, by the way. The 24-hour hotline, which is free, by the way. To education and awareness programs in every community across the country. And it does go to research. The Alzheimer's Association is the third leading funder of research and the highest funder of research that is a non-governmental entity in the world. And they're making strides each and every day. So please, give it some thought. If you're interested, please click the link in the show notes to donate to our Alzheimer's Walk Team today. Your money stays in the local communities to impact, to support, and to educate people all across the country about Alzheimer's, the warning signs, and how to get care and support. This is a disease that is quiet, but it's continually taking away lives of people all around us, including my great aunt, my neighbor, and a dear family friend. Again, the link is in the show notes to go and support our walk to end Alzheimer's. And if you just want more information, you can go to alz.org.
So let's get into the heavier topic. You told me as we were prepping for this episode that through the course of your life, you've become HIV positive.
Yeah.
And you wanted to talk about it. Are you willing to talk about it? So what's life like today? I guess is probably a good starting point.
It's like a, you know, it's a total, it's just totally different from, you know, let's say 20 years ago. You know, because life with HIV is just so much better. You know, because we can control it. You know, you're not taking 1,000 pills a day. They're not making you sick. You know, so it's come such a long way. I hate that it took that long for it to come that way. You know, for me, life is just it's just managing a chronic condition, you know, that you've got to keep under control. And that's even how our doctors kind of are teaching us, educating us to say, you know what, you know, look at it like, you know, like something like diabetes, you know, where you, if you let it get out of control, then it's very dangerous. But if you don't, then, you know, you can stay well. Today, it's amazing that I'm hearing conversations about people living with HIV and their retirement and, you know, healthcare after retirement and all those things, and getting old with HIV, you know, and getting the conditions that old people get, which to me is very positive, you know, not no pun intended, but it's just, you know, it's so great to see that, you know. It poses a new set of challenges, but that's how we keep moving forward.
So do you think, so like I grew up, I'm a little bit younger than you, not terribly, but I'm younger. And so my, you know, I grew up with it differently, grew up seeing HIV and hearing it in the news and those kind of things differently than you would have. So like, do you feel like, cause you've kind of gone through it's the period of it's a death sentence. We have some treatments, and now you're able to live, as you say, kind of with a chronic condition. Do you feel like, from your perspective, that the world and or the gay community has now started to just treat it as it's not a concern anymore? Or do you feel like we're at a point where we still understand that this is a bad thing?
You know, I mean, you know, with PrEP coming along, that was a real game changer, because I think it's, I mean, again, I think it's a good thing, but I think it sent the message that, you know, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
When really you should, and now, you know, you've also got to be reminded, you know, there's other STIs out there, you know, so you know, you got to be careful. So I think it was a real, you know, it's a game changer, but I don't think people take it any less seriously, you know, because, you know, infection rates are still high in some of the countries in Africa and communities in the US, you know, so I don't think so, but that changes. I mean, that changes like every day because you hear different stuff all the time.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I will say that you were the first person who's ever told me that they're HIV positive. So this is a new bridge for me. And so I'm just, what's that?
Well, you know, that's interesting that you say that because, you know, I've told very few people. You know, and by doing this, I'm hopefully multiplying that a little bit. You know, it's a strange thing. It's a strange thing to be told, and it's a strange thing to tell.
So that's where I wanted to go. If you could tell me a little bit about what that was like, that you're told that you have this, when that happened, what you did, like what your response was, because I've never been through anything where I've, you know, been told anything of like terrible news like that. That's about my own health. So,
yeah. It was not a surprise to me, because my boyfriend at the time, and really I still call him my first love, even though he died. He was very sick, and And all of the testing came at once, because what happened with him is that, you know, he tested positive for HIV and then developed very shortly, like within months, developed acute lymphoblastic leukemia. So at the time, you know, he had started feeling bad. He was battling something and they didn't know what it was, which is crazy. And but then he tested positive, and I was like, oh, okay, well, that kind of answers my own question.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a surprise. And I do remember, you know, my doctor was just kind of, was telling me, you know, this is what it's going to involve. And, you know, this is where we are now. And I was kind of like, okay, you know, let's go. You know, I can't sit here and feel sorry for myself. So it was just kind of, I just took a beat and then just kept going. And, you know, I think the effect of that has been sort of knock on. It wasn't an all at once kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, you look back and there's that one moment, you know, that one moment, when you hear that, but I still see a lot of, you know, a lot of change and a lot of feeling since then, you know, and that does, that, you know, that keeps going.
Yeah. So how would you say, like, your life, how has this impact? Obviously you take, you know, pills and you keep yourself healthy. That aside, like how has this changed your life or impacted your life, now years later?
Well, you know, when I first tested positive, I was not really into fitness because I was young and I thought, oh, you know, and that really got me into being physically fit. You know, my father had been a runner. You know, he ran Boston Marathon when he was 50, which is older than I am now. So I knew that could keep me healthy. So I did research. I studied, you know, it's like cardiovascular health and, you know, muscle mass and things like that just help people overcome, and they say stronger immunity, you know, all that kind of stuff. So that's kind of, I would say that's kind of a big area that changed for me. You know, also, you know, obviously dating and relationships completely changed, but that goes with the territory, I think.
What is dating like there in Florida?
You know, I don't even have words to describe it. You know, because you know, my last relationship lasted nearly 14 years.
Okay.
And a lot has changed, but he and I met in 2005 on Match.com, when you actually had to go onto an internet browser to get there. You know, it wasn't an app on your iPhone.
App, yeah.
And so you know, so now I'm in this, you know, this you know, too young to be old but too old to be young kind of demographic, and it's odd. To me, it's so strange. It's actually why I've been practicing social isolation, because it just got so scary. Where I'm, you know, I was you know, kind of going out with men that are, you know, older than I am, and kind of going, oh, okay, this is not what I want my life to look like.
Yeah.
You know, and then I've got guys that are much younger than I am, and I'm kind of like, I don't even know what to do with you. I mean, it's like, what am I supposed to do with you? You know, it's like, so it's odd. And, you know, it's very digital. You know, and certainly now I can't imagine what it's like with everybody in isolation. So, it's strange. I mean, it's very strange.
It is. And I read a story yesterday or this morning that, like, people who are deciding to go on first dates right now are doing it through Skype or FaceTiming, which I find that really odd and challenging, because, like, I guess if you can make it work through that, you can make it work in person. But
yeah, you know, I think so. It's I don't know. It's very strange. I'm not sure. That's why I'm kind of glad I'm where I am right now, is because I don't know if I'm ready for that. You know what I mean? So you know, I'm kind of just hoping to wait it out a bit.
Yeah. and that's fair. So you've been, this question just kind of came to mind, you know, being a writer, and you've got stories to tell, and you've lived kind of a really interesting life in general. Do you read other writers, or do you just kind of do your own thing?
No, I mean, I read a lot. I reread a lot. You know, and it depends on my mood at the time. It depends on what I really want to be reading. I picked up War and Peace and couldn't get halfway through that, you know, because it really is as cantankerous as they say it is. But I have just such a wide variety, but I do a lot of reading. Probably I should be doing some writing at the same time, but really now it's just tons of reading. I can read, you know, two or three books at the same time, and that keeps me happy. It's strange, but it keeps me happy.
I mean, I'm doing two at the same time. One's these are both nonfiction. Typically I would do a fiction and a nonfiction. That way my brain can kind of operate in two separate spheres. But I did try, much to my, I tried to make my old English teacher happy last year. I read a Hemingway for the first time. I felt bad that it took me 35 years to do so, but I finally did. So I was pretty proud of myself for doing that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for me, it was kind of setting goals like that, like Hemingway. I mean, you know, because I had read some in high school and not really gone back to it in college. And so just a couple of years ago, I picked up, you know, a couple of the novels and read them. And it's been a new kind of appreciation to go back to things that we were forced to read and actually do it when you want to. And that puts it all in a different, puts it in a different light completely.
Absolutely. I mean, you can gain more and be impacted by it more now that you've got that life experience. And I hate saying that because, like, I don't want to be that guy who's like, oh, and when I was your age, da da da. But like, it's true. I feel like it's true.
I agree. It is. Yeah. I think it's just, we have to be careful how we say things like that. That's it.
Well, I want to end with a couple of fun questions that I ask all of the participants, or all the interviewees, I guess is what I'll call my guests. Don't think about them very hard. They're meant to be fun. And first one, what is your hidden talent?
That's a tough one. My hidden talent would be singing, because I did used to do it in public, but now I do not. So I sing in the shower.
We all sing in the shower, but
yeah, no, I really do. I actually really do. Yeah.
Awesome. What's your favorite kind of pizza?
Good Italian sausage, lots of cheese, thick crust. Yeah. That kind of thing.
But I might know the answer to this question, but if you're on death row, what is your last meal going to consist of?
I think it would have to, you know, ideally it would be my father's lasagna, but yeah, it would have to be something Italian, because that's where my culinary history comes from.
What is your song or musical artist that you always go to?
Believe by Cher. Yep.
Is that the one you sing in the shower?
Yeah, sometimes. You notice there was no hesitation there, right?
No, you knew that one. That was
yeah, absolutely. That, yeah, yep.
And what is your favorite word?
Oh boy, that's a tough one. You know, I like the word indubitably for some reason. I'm not sure why, because I don't really use it. But that's a favorite, because it just kind of rolls off the tongue, I think.
And no one uses it, so it's very different.
Well, exactly. And, you know, it's not something that you would exclaim or something like that.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, it's an odd choice, but that's the first thing that came to my mind.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, if people want to find you, where can they do that?
They can do it on Instagram or Facebook. I am not on Twitter, because I just can't. At Chris Almasano, yeah, that's me.
Perfect. Well, I appreciate you joining the Live It Well podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it, Richard.
And that wraps up the conversation with Chris. There's a lot to unpack in that conversation, and I think what I take away is kind of, he said something when we were talking about how he got his job in learning and development. He said, you have to ask for opportunities. And I think that that's important in life. That's important in career. That's important in relationships. Wherever you are in life, I think it's just so important to not be afraid to ask. And something someone told me at a conference once, or a speaker or something, he said, the worst that can happen when you ask is someone can say no. And if it's for a job opportunity or a date or whatever it may be, like, is no the worst thing? Most times it's not. It's just, it's what it is. And so embracing that and welcoming that and not being afraid of what that is and what that can mean is so powerful and so important. So I thank Chris for that message. And then talking about his HIV status, I know was not easy for Chris, and I appreciate him being open about that, because I firmly believe that the more in this world that we are open about the things that we are dealing with, that we have overcome, the better off we're going to be and the more understanding we can have. And so I'm glad Chris was comfortable having that conversation and being willing to talk through how that's changed his life and what he's learned through that process. So I hope you took something from that piece as well. I know I did, because I was a little apprehensive to even ask the questions. And he said it was okay to ask the questions, but life is hard, and I get that. And this podcast is all about how do we embrace where we are and where we want to go so that we do have that mantra of live it well. And so I firmly believe Chris embodies that, and I appreciate him coming on to share that story with us. It's been fun so far having these guests on. I can't wait where we go from here. Chris was a wonderful addition to this season, and we will be back again in 2 weeks with another wonderful guest. I know you're going to love her. She also has some great stories, some great insights, has overcome some really shitty situations. So please come back in 2 weeks. If you love this episode, if you're loving this series, please do go leave us a rating. It means the world. I read them all. And it helps other people find these episodes as well when people rate them. So please do go hit that, hopefully a 5-star, maybe a 4-star. But I'm loving putting these together, and I'm going to keep doing it. So again, thank you for listening, and I'll see you again in 2 weeks. The music for this episode is Ukulele Fun by Raphael Crux. The credit for the music is found in the show notes. And as always, we can be found online at Live It Well Podcast on Instagram, or you can find me, your host, on Instagram, at Richard Edor. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks.